This is Tracy.
And this is Sheila.
And we are Survive Fat Chicks. And for the first time in about a month, I think, we're actually out recording someplace instead of staying at home. Yeah, we're in the field. We're down at Mariposa Market on Mississauga Street right now. We just thought we'd come down here for a change. Never recorded down here before.
Yeah, we have.
We tried. It didn't work. It was too noisy. Because we used to always try to come in the afternoon on like a weekend.
Yeah.
And this place is just hopping on the weekend. So we came down. It's like a Thursday at 5, 6 o'clock. And it's a little bit calmer. But you could still hear, you know, lots of customers and things like that. So bear with us. For those of you that like having the background noise for atmosphere, I hope you're happy. For those of you who hate it, sorry.
Write it and tell us otherwise.
Yes. We are lonely. We want to hear from you. Even though we just did the Julie and Julia episode, we want to do another book review because Sheila picked up a really interesting book at Half Price Books a few weeks ago. It's called Last Chance to Eat by Gina Mallett, and it's all about food.
Well, it's all about how there are certain cornerstone flavors that, because of politics and government regulation, they're vanishing from our plates.
A little background, Gina Mallett, and I'm probably butchering her name, is...
Well, she's English. I imagine it'd be Mallett, not Mallet.
Mallet. She's a journalist. She does restaurant reviews. She's a food critic. So she's like the anti-Zvive Fat Chicks. Because she's kind of a food snob.
Well,
so when you go into this book and you start reading it, you have to understand that she's looking at things with what she would probably call a more cultured palate than what normal people look at. Whereas Sheila and I look at food and try to look at it for what it is, not judge it for what it isn't.
But we have a real world palate versus a critic's palate.
Exactly. Like for us, presentation on a dish, meh, doesn't care as long as it's not all slopped together in one messy pile. Whereas somebody like her, that would be a big deal. But we're going to go through this and argue with each other chapter by chapter because I loved and hated the book, and Sheila really liked it. So,
first, Anthony Bourdain likes it, so it must be good. After all, he's the television host that's made up of cigarettes and wine.
He's a food snob, too. But she looks at a couple of different basic foods and how they're being changed and how she's mourning their loss, pretty much. The first chapter is all about the egg. So what do you want to start with this one?
It's been so long, I can't remember.
Well, I'll start with my complaints.
Throw out your outrage and I'll counter.
I was outraged because I started reading this. The first chapter, she comes off like one of those people that French cooking is the end-all and be-all and everything else is beneath it. And that was kind of her attitude in the entire first chapter because the egg is so critical to French cooking. I think now that I look back in retrospect, I was a little bit harsh on it.
Just a tad.
But that's how I felt while she was talking about it, about how eggs aren't what they used to be. She had a... There's a lot of neat stuff in here, like memoir style, of her growing up after the war in England, and about how her family tried to keep chickens, and the chickens were laying the eggs and they couldn't find them. They didn't find them until it flooded, and then all the rotted eggs came bobbing up with the flood.
So, and in those days, they had egg inspectors to make sure that you weren't hoarding food, because it was during the war?
Or right after the war, so it was still, supplies were still scarce. So, and she talks a lot about her family and her, she grew up kind of privileged. They had a cook. They had, like, a house in London and a house outside.
But I beg to differ, though, because in England at that time, a middle-class family would have had a cook. That's something you don't really see in North America, is the domestic servant class.
Yeah.
And for us, only the rich can afford to have a cook or a servant. In England, middle-class people were able to afford having...
Yeah.
Cooks and servants.
That's true, but she also admits that a lot of her exposure to French cooking came because her father was some muckety-muck in a major hotel chain. So she traveled with her father. She got to go to all these like crazy French restaurants because they lived in France for a while while he was the vice president of something and running this one hotel. So she comes off more of a food snob in this chapter than any other chapter in the book. And she really gets in-depth about French cooking, its roots, how important the egg is. And that was kind of nice. Because I read this right on the heels of Julie and Julia, and it kind of gave me a different perspective, a more negative perspective. It was what my former perspective was on French cooking. And I hate to agree with her, but I do agree with her that we've done some horrible things to the egg. Like, now that you can buy pasteurized eggs, and they don't behave right anymore.
No. And you're expecting you to be able to mess with something that we've been using since... we used sharp pointy sticks to run after furry elephants.
Mm-hmm.
We've been cooking them since then, and now you're expecting them to behave the same way? We tinkered with them so much?
Yeah, and I liked the two-pronged approach she took to that. She took in the whole salmonella goblin and how everybody made such a big deal of it and how rare it really is. And now we have pasteurized eggs, so you don't have to worry about that anymore if you want to make a real mayonnaise or something else.
It's like nanny state overkill.
Yeah.
They take a small percentage of the population, which should have choices that are whatever the ingredient that they are allergic to or shouldn't consume. And they totally make it widespread so that the rest of the 90% of the population can't even find the original raw ingredients anymore.
If you're pregnant, don't eat real mayonnaise. If you're pregnant, don't eat a Caesar salad. If your kid's young, don't let them lick the beaters. If you're worried about salmonella whenever you make cookies, that's a common sense approach. Right. I always did it growing up. I was fine.
So did I. And so the actual instances of salmonella in eggs is pretty rare.
Yeah.
But she brings up how it's the same thing with milk, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit.
Pasteurizing milk. That's another chapter.
How in order to make it fit for everybody to consume, they have to kind of homogenize it, which...
It's not even the homogenization. They have to pasteurize the hell out of it.
Right.
And they get too much pasteurization going on. But I don't want to go into that chapter, because I also want to talk about how she really covers the best I've ever seen of anybody about how the egg has been demonized. Of it's a food that's bad for you. Now it's good for you. Now it's bad for you. And
the cholesterol will kill you. No, it's the good cholesterol you need it to live. Yeah.
And the final result is pretty much eggs are good for you. The cholesterol will not kill you. It's a good kind of cholesterol. It's just, she really comes down hard on the food scientists and how they jump to knee-jerk reactions and publicize it and use fear to push it. And that's always something Sheila and I have mocked in modern media is,
well, I mean, you can
fear sells.
Fear. Yeah. But you can look at that with any scientist that involves themselves in any sort of cause that can be political, where you can find, you could find people that in the 1950s, doctors that said that smoking was good for you and it cleared out your airways.
Oh yeah, they used to prescribe menthol cigarettes for people who had a cold and things. That was wacky.
And I'm not comparing cigarettes to eggs but I'm just saying, you can find scientists that will say it'll kill you. You can find scientists that say it'll make you live forever.
I'm sorry, it wasn't a pasteurized egg. It was irradiated eggs that sucked. I think
but
the pasteurized eggs are
them
just as bad, though. So they come out kind of cloudy, and they're not as good to cook with. So,
I mean, why?
I never thought about it. I always thought it was a good thing until I read this, and I realized, wow, if you're hardcore into food and hardcore into cooking, you make one minor little change to a critical ingredient like an egg, because so many dishes rely on the protein in the yolk or rely on the stuff in the white to whip. That if you can't get a good stiffy whiting anymore, I mean, look at the Belgian waffles we had the other day. We wouldn't have been able to do those if the eggs did not behave how they're supposed to.
Right.
So I appreciated the egg chapter after I got over it a little bit.
Well, like, they do have pasteurized eggs. If you're not going to use them for meringues or for emulsions, then you can use the stuff that comes in the carton that's already whipped and pasteurized. So it's not like somebody that has an immune deficiency that are very worried about salmonella or whatever.
Yeah.
You don't have access to it. But I'm just afraid that they're going to go whole hog. That's all you're going to be able to get is pasteurized eggs. When 95% of the population is fine with eggs the way they are.
I imagine this egg black market where this farmer has like one of those camping cases of eggs in his trench coat. You know, the hard cases. He's like, hey, buddy, want to buy an egg? They're fresh, you know?
Yeah.
I just imagine that someday.
Haven't
that would be
been
horrible.
Nuked, haven't been heated up to kill all the bacteria in it.
Tastes like it's right out of the chicken.
Because it is.
So that was the egg chapter. There's a lot of interesting stuff out there to read about what's happened to the egg in the past 50 years. If you're interested, go check it out. It did open my eyes a bit. It left a bad taste in my mouth overall because she was such a food snob. But the next couple chapters, she totally redeems herself.
Well, now, just before we start that, I'd like to say that I approached this book, and probably the reason why I enjoyed it was because I guess I'm like an amateur nutritional anthropologist, and I like seeing how food and culture
dovetail
together. Yeah, exactly. And so much of what we are, so much of what our culture is, regardless of where our ancestors came from, is tied to food. And even now with our modern culture, it's what brings us together.
Yeah. So, I was a little hard on it. I was actually screaming at the book when I started reading it.
She was?
Yeah. I was having a fit. But I'm better now. The next chapter is the one that Sheila and I are probably going to just totally go nuts with. Is the cheese chapter, because we adore cheese.
Yes. Cheese rules. I love cheese.
Cheese! Not even Wensleydale.
What's wrong with Wensleydale?
We're big Wallace and Gromit
fans. I like
Wensleydale. So, the second chapter, The Last Brie. And she really talks about how cheese making as an art has declined in Europe and France especially, and a lot of it has to do with the pasteurization of milk. It doesn't taste like it used to make cheese. And this is something we found out from just previous things we've looked at. You need raw milk is best because you want all the stuff that's in the milk to make the cheese. You need all those enzymes still active and running around. When you start to pasteurize cheese, you take out what makes pasteurized milk, you take out what's there that makes cheese possible. If you ultra pasteurize milk, you make it even worse. And there's a process in pasteurization, or rather, when they pasteurize, they have two routes they can go. They could do it hard and fast, or they raise the heat really fast, really high, and they could pasteurize more milk at a time. Or they can do it slowly and bring it back down slowly, and that doesn't kill as much as the stuff. But because that takes longer, most places go the ultra pasteurization route. If you're interested in making cheese as an amateur, going out and buying a cheese kit, good luck, especially in the United States, finding milk that you can use that would be appropriate to make cheese with. We tried. Right. We went through every single grocery store in Morgantown at one point, and we could not find one carton of anything that wasn't ultra-pasteurized. Now, you can sneak by the pasteurized stuff, but ultra-pasteurized is too much.
Yeah, there isn't anything left alive in it to make cheese.
So, and that's pretty much the pivot point of this chapter, and that's something that makes me cry a little on the inside, that one, they're forcing this to happen in France.
Right.
Because that really is the culture of the soft cheese centers. I mean, that sounds so weird to say that, but brie is nothing more French than that.
Right. And it's not just the pasteurization of the milk, it's the whole dairy industry, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because
the different batches of milk,
Well, the different kinds of cows that they use. There's this brown cow that they usually use. It produces a very high butterfat milk, and those are being replaced with English breeds, mm-hmm. such as the Holstein, and they produce more milk, which is why they're switching over to them, but the milk isn't as suitable to cheese making. It is fine for putting on your cereal or,
you know, drinking a glass with your sandwich or something, but you're not going to make a good cheese out of it. And also, another interesting point that she brought up that I had never even thought of before was when you have the small local farms making cheese, the cows, the milk will taste different from farm to farm depending on what the cows have been eating. And when all the milks from all the same little group of cows have all been feeding on the same things, you get a different kind of tasting milk, and that produces a different kind of tasting cheese.
It's so like
you
a regionalism.
Literally, you get a regional cheese that only will taste that way from that region because of the grass the cows ate, because of how the grass is growing in that area. It reminds me a lot about how Cuban tobacco, you could take the seeds out of Cuba and grow them someplace else, but they don't taste like Cuban tobacco. It's like the same thing.
In winemaking, it's called the terroir, which is the taste of the land.
But when you take milking and you take cheese making and you up it to an industrial level where you're taking all of the cows and milking them all together and they're spread out all over the place and all the milk's going to a central location and being mixed together to make cheese, you homogenize all the flavor out of it. You're mixing everything together and you're losing those little strands. And I'm not saying this is all bad, because one nice thing about an industrial approach to food is it makes it easier to feed more people cheaper. We do have a lot of mouths to feed on the planet. We do have to keep that in mind. But at the same time, at an artisan level, for a nice treat, I hate to see some of those flavors get lost, because you're never going to find them again.
They're going to literally disappear, you know, and that would be a terrible thing. And like you, I understand that we need to make sure that we make enough that we can feed our people, but it just seems so sad that something so special could be lost so easily, and most people don't even realize that it's happening.
Now, there is, ironically, as you're seeing a decline in some areas in France because of this, there's a rise in the States, though, of artisan cheesemaking, whereas we used to be like a cheese wasteland.
Well, it was all Wisconsin cheddar, right? Which is tasty in and of itself.
And American cheese, which I'm still not sure what American cheese is.
It's an edible oil product.
Well, no, the real American cheese isn't. Because remember how you can go to a deli and buy sliced American cheese versus the stuff that doesn't even need to be refrigerated? There's real American cheese that actually tastes like cheese, but it's like a really mild, bland cheddar versus the pasteurized, whatever, processed cheese food product that you can leave out on the shelf and it'll stay good for 100 years. That's like the slices that are individually wrapped.
For our Canadian listeners, American cheese are cheese slices.
Yeah. So
that's what they're called here.
But there's been a resurgence of it, and she even touches on that in here about how you get a lot of the artisan cheeses in the States. You have the goat farms that are making, specializing in goat milk cheese.
Yeah.
And that's interesting, too.
There's a bunch in Vermont, too, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, New England's filthy with it. And I really appreciate how she approached this chapter. I didn't know, also, this is an interesting brie fact. When you buy brie, you know how you can get those cute little mini wheels of brie at the store, or you can buy the wedges that are cut off the big wheel? You actually want the wedge cut off the big wheel because the bigger the brie, the better it's supposed to taste.
The thinner the rind.
Yeah.
So that's supposed to be... I mean, I like the rind, but it's ratio not supposed of brie to be to rind. Like all rind all the time.
Yeah. Because I guess when you make... They used to make big wheels of it for families because a family could consume a whole wheel before it went bad. But as people were eating less cheese and families are smaller and farmers don't have, 12 children, or they're selling it commercially, they're making the smaller wheels. But if you have the option of getting the wedge or getting the little cute wheel, yeah, cute's cool, but go with the wedge. So, anything else you wanted to add about raw milk versus cheese?
I don't think so. Remember, in Pennsylvania?
Oh, yeah.
That dairy that got busted for selling raw milk.
And wasn't there somebody up in Canada that's been trying to sell it, too, and they got in trouble? It was just right after we moved here, I think.
Yeah, he was selling it to customers, which is fine, but then I guess he was selling stuff that wasn't labeled as being raw milk to people, which is bad. That's a no-no.
I think you should...
Because if you've got older folks or children in the house...
Yeah, you don't want them to eat that.
Right.
Because they could get sick from it if they have a suppressed immune system or...
But I want the option to be there.
The option for somebody who's an artisan and they want to do their own cheeses. They should have the option to go out and buy the raw milk.
Right.
Maybe you should be licensed for it. Maybe you should have to put a little tax stamp on it. Like you do for cigarettes or something. That's fine.
Or for hunting.
Yeah,
like
for hunting.
You get so many deer, you know.
Yeah, you could produce so many hundreds of gallons of raw milk a year to sell. Once you produce all of that, you don't get any more. That'd be fine.
Right.
But I think I don't want to see that kind of thing lost.
Right.
Not when it has a legitimate, useful purpose. And also with cheeses, they found that there was some kind of bacteria. Remember, it wasn't aged past a certain point.
Yeah.
If it was made with raw milk. So in the States, you couldn't get any cheese that wasn't aged past 64 days it was made with raw milk or something.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole lot of food science in it that really was blown out of proportion again by the food science community that she really latches on to. She's kind of anti-food science in a way.
Right.
So great chapter. Really good eye-opener. And I'm sorry this seems like such a classroom situation. We're going through each chapter, but each chapter is so totally different from the last one. It's like a mini book.
Yeah, it is. And again, we're not poo-pooing public health. We just want there to be options out there for some of the older ways.
Yeah, not as a lifestyle, but as something nice for a treat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not going to live off of brie, but I like to have it for a treat once in a while. Okay, I know you'd live off of brie if you could.
Yes, I would. It's delicious.
I know.
Charlemagne can't be wrong.
Okay, next up is The Ox is Gored, Chapter 3. This one's all about meat, or rather beef.
Beef specifically.
She talks a little bit about like lamb and pork, a little bit about the villainization of pork and how we overcook pork to no end anymore.
Oh, because of trichinosis.
Yeah, because trichinosis dies at what, 135, 140?
Yeah.
But they recommend you cook pork to like 175, which overcooks it, which I've been doing for years. It wasn't until this past year Sheila made pork chops and we started not timing it, but checking the temperature on them and pulling them right around 150 when we knew the trichinosis, if it existed, which there hasn't been a case in years.
Well, any bacteria dies at 140, so as long as it's above 140, you're good.
So we started pulling it around 145, 150, and there's such a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
it's tender.
It's tender, it's juicy.
It's not dry.
It has flavor. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Really good. That makes a big difference. But I'm trying to remember this one here.
Oh. Well, there is the horrors of industrial farming.
Yeah, which is evil.
But even though there's a light at the end of the tunnel, because some of the big fast food places like McDonald's and Burger King have pushed for cageless chickens,
mm-hmm.
which was mentioned in the egg chapter, and there is some noise that they're going to start doing the same thing for where they're getting their beef from. That the cattle be inspected, that it not contain any downer cattle, which is horrible.
Yeah.
And it's just gross.
Well, I was also impressed with the idea that McDonald's threw its weight behind something like that. And that was not something I ever expected to hear. Well, everybody just like left. It got really quiet here. But that was not something I ever expected to hear about McDonald's. Because everybody lumps McDonald's in with Walmart and being the evil
super
empires.
Evil. Yeah.
But to see them throw their weight behind trying to do a more humane practice for animals that we're going to
more
eat.
More humane raising and mm-hmm. less mechanical stripping of the meat, mm-hmm. of the carcasses. Because it's doing the mechanical stripping that where you start get the spinal fluid and mixed in with the meat,
and that's
how mad cow disease can be spread by meat.
And it actually reminded me a little bit of that one article we read on Slate, which is from a book that I do want to get my hands on about food in France, McDonald's in France too. And it was talking about how McDonald's is actually thriving in France, and one of the ways they did it is the fellow who's running the show over there for the McDonald's Corporation, he started emphasizing that McDonald's there buys a lot of local produce, and they buy from local French farmers, and that's where they get a lot of their basic staples to produce. And I thought that was really neat, too, that McDonald's, such a big evil corporation is how we look at them, because they're fast food, can turn around and do that. If they can do that there, why aren't they doing that here?
Well, could I think you they're starting to.
Like, McDonald's could support in the States, because there are so many more McDonald's in the States than up here. They could support so many family farms alone if they were to start buying locally. That would be a huge food revolution.
And people would definitely, because people want to eat local. It's just hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's being made hard to eat local. So if you were to give them an even easier way to do that, people would be all over that.
So there's what, two real main points here in the beef chapter. One is that beef was villainized also by mad cow disease, which is something to be legitimately concerned about, but with safe cattle practices, it can be controlled and eliminated.
Right.
We just have to test aggressively. We have to make sure we're not feeding ground-up animal brains to other animals.
Don't feed
people.
Them that. They're herbivores. Don't feed them that.
Yeah.
Just straight out.
Yeah, just because you want to plump them up so they're better for market, you really shouldn't do that. And the other point was the difference between dry aging and wet aging, too. That was something I never realized. To explain that, since I assume most of you have no idea what I'm talking about, so I didn't really recognize it either, is that when you go to age a piece of meat, that's what makes it taste good. That's what makes it tender.
Right. Because the water doesn't really add any flavor, so by letting the water evaporate, you're concentrating the flavor in the meat.
Yeah, you want to bring your meat. It's like a controlled rot.
Yeah, it's like ripening the meat.
Yeah, it's just like fruit. Well, you think of ripening the meat, you think of flies buzzing around it, but that's not it at all. It's not in a sanitary way.
Yeah, like a pear doesn't taste like anything if it's rock hard.
Mm-hmm.
But when it gets to that perfect point of being ripe, and it's a controlled rot.
Yeah.
Then it tastes delicious. It tastes beautiful.
So, and it... But with the dry aging, which makes it taste even better, it's fallen out of favor. They've gone to wet aging. And I believe it was because it retained more weight, so they could sell more and get more for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't allow all the water to evaporate, because it's sitting in liquid, which is supposed to be more sanitary.
And it's also because they don't send out the whole cow anymore.
Yeah.
The slaughterhouses disassemble everything there and send it out in vacuum packs, which are great. They keep stuff fresh. But it also makes it harder for the steakhouses to dry age now. So it's become more of a rare thing to find a steakhouse that actually dry ages their beef. I think it's almost gone completely. I don't think there's a handful of places that do it anymore. I'd love to go to one that does. I'd like to find one and save up the cash for like a special dinner just to try it once and see the difference.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can dry age at home. Remember that one episode
with Good Eats
where he made this rig up and put the meat in this drain dish so that the moisture had somewhere to go? Poked a bunch of holes in the lid so it had something covering it, but this moisture could still escape, and put it in the refrigerator. And he recommended doing it for a couple of days, I think.
You think it's like 2 to 3 days minimum, and it'll lose weight, but it'll concentrate the flavor, and it'll taste even better. So I'm just flipping through to make sure I don't miss any other good points. And she gives beef the same treatment she does eggs and cheese, where look how it's been villainized by food science between E. coli and all these other issues going on. She touches a bit on organic foods, but not too much. Something we haven't brought up yet about this that I actually enjoyed thoroughly were the recipes she puts in throughout the book.
Yeah, there is recipes interspersed, and I'd actually like to try some of them.
Yeah, and it's usually pertinent to whatever the chapter is about. So if it's about beef, there's going to be a couple meat. She has like a steak and kidney pie recipe in there. She had a couple good cheese recipes in there. Oh, horse, too.
Yeah.
She talks about horse steaks and how it's a lean animal, it's a clean animal, it doesn't have a history of diseases.
Right.
That would be transmittable through the meat, and how it actually tastes pretty darn good.
But because so many people see horses as companion animals, I don't see us going there anytime soon. I mean, well, you see the same thing with buffalo, but buffalo aren't seen as companion animals. Nobody walks up to a buffalo and goes, oh, it's so cute. Mm-hmm. I identify with it. I believe I have part of a buffalo soul in me.
Yeah. I want to try horse, actually. I want to try it someplace where it's done well. And I think there was a slight rise with mad cow disease that horse meat ticked up a little bit in its consumption because it was safe to do. So I liked the beef chapter. The kitchen garden, the next chapter. This one is a lot of the same as in the beginning. Villainization, food science is ruining our food. And when it comes to produce, because they're not breeding for taste anymore.
Yeah.
They're breeding for production.
And hardiness.
Yeah, quantity, not quality. And there was nothing of a real surprise in this chapter. I appreciated Jessica, at this point she was preaching to the choir. It's a real shame to go to the store and buy this gorgeous looking tomato and cut into it and taste like nothing.
Yeah.
Red Delicious apples were one of the ones that she really targeted on here. And I've never really been that fond of Red Delicious, and I never understood why. Now I understand why.
Because they taste like water.
They taste like
water. They don't taste like anything.
Red apples are bred because they did a statistical study, grocery stores did a statistical study and found that red apples sell better. So instead of getting the mottled looking ones like some of the Fujis and Pink Ladies and things look like.
Macintosh are usually half green, half red.
They go for the pretty ones because people buy those because they look good, and then they buy them and get them home and realize they don't taste very good. So that's something that we as consumers just kind of have to put our foot down and say, no, we want to buy something that's good.
Yeah.
But they're seeing a lot of heirloom varieties of produce disappearing. They're not around anymore. She talks about one species of apple that's almost gone.
Yeah.
And there's dozens other that have been lost. Same thing with the tomatoes, about how the Belgians, was it Dutch?
No. The Dutch.
Yeah. They've changed how tomatoes are bred now, and, well, the ones that are on the vine taste better, but it's not as good as it used to be.
Yeah.
Kind of deal. So.
And hydroponics.
Hydroponics, yeah. Again, it's.
I mean, part of it is.
You're totally right.
It is our own fault.
Yeah.
Because we were the ones that let them tell us what we want. We were the ones that demanded fruit all year round and vegetables and didn't eat according to the seasons. So, yes, we have brought ourselves here, but we can bring ourselves back. And you do see that with more heirloom varieties showing up in megamarts. Mm-hmm. Like some of the really weird looking tomatoes.
Yeah.
Some of the weirder looking carrots. Like I've seen like purple carrots, which look like the medieval carrots.
Yeah, because carrots weren't orange until the
1800s.
Yeah. And also, this one shocked me about the European Union, about how they have standards to sell an apple. It has to be a certain size, and if it doesn't hit that size, won't be allowed to be sold.
Yeah.
So you eliminate a lot of heirloom varieties right there because they're not big enough. Whereas you get some tiny little apples that taste great. And also how we breed for sweet, because a modern palate really likes sweet things, so a lot of apples have been bred to be sweeter, and you're losing some of the tart taste in apples. Too.
Right. Like Macintosh is my favorite because it's got a perfect balance of tart and sweet. You really feel it in your cheek. You feel that sourness, but it's not so sour that you don't want to keep eating it. It's got that sweetness too. It's a nice balanced apple. I really love them.
I don't like Macintosh that much. I know. I like Pink Lady. I just wish they were a little tarter, too. I agree with her in this. Pink Ladies are a little too sweet. If they were a little tart, it'd be the perfect apple. It was, again, an interesting chapter. No real eye-openers there, but worth a read. If you don't really know how produce has changed in the past 50, 60 years, definitely worth picking up just for that chapter alone. Now, fish is the fish chapter, which I believe is the next one and the last one in the book. I think this is where she gets a little wishy-washy.
Well, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
Yeah.
She's really, I don't know, she painted her argument into a corner, I think.
Yeah.
Because she derailed about how wild fish are being overfished and
farm fish is killing wild fish.
Farm fish is killing wild fish because of the pollution from farm fishing.
Yeah. Because, again, things I didn't know. Now, I knew that we had farm fishing and we had wild fishing, and the wild fish are more expensive. And they're more rare. That's why we don't really see them on the market as much anymore, because we fish a lot of things to extinction. And I knew farm fish were supposed to not taste nearly as good, though I've heard to the contrary that there's a lot of farm fish varieties now that taste just as good, if not better.
Right.
Like catfish is one. Mm-hmm. I've had both, and I think farm-raised catfish is far superior.
I think farm-raised catfish actually tastes cleaner.
Yeah.
I know people are like, they feed them dog food, but unless I see it myself, I'm very not inclined to believe it.
Yeah. So what if they feed them dog food?
As long as it tastes good.
Yeah,
that's all I care
about.
As long
as it's not full of, I don't know, spinal fluid from a mad cow, I don't care.
Right.
So, and she also talks about shrimp, which a couple of interesting pieces of trivia I didn't know. Apparently you don't want to eat, black tiger shrimp?
Yeah.
Because they taste like nothing. You get a neat little crash course in the book about how to pick shrimp and what type are good, what type are bad. When you can get wild shrimp you want to, they taste better apparently. But I didn't know that about the black tiger shrimp, and well, I've kind of avoided buying them lately. Mostly,
they're usually expensive anyway, so I usually don't end up getting them.
Mostly it's a juxtaposition between wild fishing versus the farm fishing. And farm fishing produces a huge amount of pollution because you have all these fish in a tiny little area, and they poop a lot.
Yeah.
And they're in water. They're in, like, an ocean area that's kind of closed in.
Yeah, it's an enclosure on the ocean.
Yeah, so then as they poop, it all kind of goes into the ocean, and it creates too much poop, and it kills other things, and it pollutes the area. Because too much fish poop is a bad thing.
Too much of any poop is a bad thing.
Yeah, good point. There's no such thing as good poop. But, again, an interesting chapter. She did slander our favorite piece of sushi, though. Tamago.
Oh, yeah. Oh, boo hiss.
See? I knew I'd get her to boo hiss at the book. She doesn't appreciate tamago for its
apparently,
virtues.
According to her, it's the only reason to have it is to test a sushi maker's rice technique. But I really like the taste of them, and I really love them. Mm-hmm. So I'll eat tamago, two-fisted. Just to spite her.
We'll take her a portion. So overall, I liked the book. if you're curious about where your food comes from and why it tastes different than it did 20 years ago, so I hear people say that all the time, this doesn't taste as good as it used to, I would recommend picking it up. If you're up in Canada, Half Price Books has them.
Yeah.
There's copies all over the place called Last Chance to Eat by Gina Mallet. In the States, there's Half Price Books in the States. I don't know if it's the same chain or not, but you can check there to see if you can get a hold of it. Really, it's a worthwhile read. It's very informative. She has a great, easy-to-read style. She mixes a lot of childhood memories in with it to make it easy to read. It's not just dry fact after fact after fact.
Yeah. So it's got an applicable story with it.
So as much as I think she's a
food snob,
to
help you understand it in context.
Exactly. Plus the recipes are pretty cool. I do want to try some of those. So I give it 2 thumbs up, though I think she's a food snob.
I thought it was an enjoyable read, except for her tamago-hating ways.
Oh, don't worry. Someday the tamago revolution will come for her. So, anything else you wanted to add about that in general? Anything that we've seen lately to bring into it?
I can see why Anthony Bourdain appreciates it, because he is definitely a foodie.
Oh, yeah.
And his show...
No Reservations.
No Reservations, where he goes around and tastes stuff in its natural environment. I can see why he'd applaud this and say, everybody should be looking at this to see how we can salvage things, see how we can make things better, see how we can make things taste as good as they used to, and stop the damage from over-safety-ifying everything. Again, not hating on public health, it's a wonderful thing, but there should be some small segment of agriculture that's allowed to be raw for artisanal foodstuffs.
In a twisted way, that makes me think of the reservations in Transmetropolitan, the comic book, where they have cultures that are put off in this little reservation to preserve the culture and cut off from humanity.
Yeah.
So they can continue to develop just that little microcosm of that culture that otherwise would die out. It's like that. We need to almost put, like, make these little food reservations where you can still get... A reservation has such a negative connotation, but that's... I'm using it from the Transmetropolitan context.
Right, written by Warren Ellis.
Written by Warren Ellis, but you almost want something like that, where you can preserve it almost for an art's sake at that point.
For heritage as well.
It's just like how students, when they go to art school, even if they're going for, like, some kind of graphic design thing, when they go through their basic classes, art classes in university, they still have to learn how to paint with oil, so they still have to learn to do fast sketches.
Right.
Even though they may never use the technique, they're going to only design with computer, they still have to learn how to do it. It's the same thing that people going into the culinary arts should learn to appreciate and learn to use the raw ingredients, like raw milk. They should learn how to make real mayonnaise. Well, they do anyway, but I mean,
yeah,
you want to always make sure that's kept in the pipeline, because you never know when you're going to need it. And in another situation the book kept reminding me of is the trans fat cluster...
Scare.
There's a certain profane word that would go after cluster. Because we went through so many years of butter is evil, butter is bad, butter will kill you. Use this. This is great. Use shortening. It's good for you. And then we find out this stuff is so... And margarine. And it's so full of things that are so bad for us that our body cannot process out that will kill you. And now we have to get rid of it again. And now people are digging their heels and saying, no, it tastes so good. I want to keep it.
It's easy to spread. It doesn't rip the bread.
Yeah, but everything with trans fat tastes good. Well, you know what? Go back to cooking with butter and you're going to find everything with butter tastes even better.
Yeah.
Just use it in moderation. There's nothing wrong with moderation, as the fat chick says. I know it's a little ironic there, but it's true. So
all things in moderation.
Even exercise, which is why I'm fat. So we've kind of gone off on the deep end and gotten all philosophical. Our next episode will be something normal again, we promise. I just thought this was one we needed to do, because we both had such strong opinions about this book.
Just watching you read it, sitting on the sofa, just yelling at her and gritting your teeth at the book.
But I enjoyed it in the long run. She rescued herself with cheeses. But I've got nothing else to add. So this is Tracy.
And this is Sheila. And we are Zwei Fat Chicks. Thanks for listening.
We hope you enjoyed this Zwei Fat Chicks podcast. Please add us as a friend on MySpace and or Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter. Please email your comments, questions, or suggestions to zweifatchicks@gmail.com. That's zweifatchicks@gmail.com. Our theme music is Hot Swing by Kevin MacLeod. Our podcasts, like Mr. MacLeod's music, are protected under a Creative Commons attribute copyright. You can make copies of our shows and share them with friends, but please make sure that credit is given. Once again, thank you for tuning in, and we hope you have a great day.